Basically, I'm going to talk a little bit about relational comparisons. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the work I've been doing, and then think about Cleveland. So this is the kind of structure, a little bit of an introduction. Talk a little bit about some of the literature that exists about how we think about the development of waterfronts. And it's a walk down the kind of redeveloped waterfronts around the world. Think about the form they take and how they've increasingly come to look very similar, and why that might be the case. I'm then going to focus and talk a bit about how theoretically some existing literature to try to grapple with waterfront redevelopment. And then I'll talk a little bit about Cleveland and how Cleveland in 2008, 2009 came to be, kind of city is. And then try and give you an alternative view. And in particular, I'm going to talk about one plan, one document, how it came to be assembled, put together, the labour that was involved in that, and the other places that got referenced in the assembling of this document. And then talk a little bit about the end, about what this might mean. Oh, okay. So, by way of an introduction, so I should also say the other thing that runs through my career so far is working with other people. So I often owe people a whole range of debts, and this is no different. So the project, the programme of research is largely just me, but at various times I've worked with other people. And this paper is a piece of work I've produced with a former PhD student of mine who's now at the University of Liverpool, called Ian Cook. Anyway, so the paper I'm going to talk about today, and the title I gave John, is refers to a wider research project I've been involved with for a number of years, the heart of which really is to think about cities slightly differently, if you like. I think, as John already said, what my previous interests have been about, trying to think of, go back to some of them and rethink them, particularly rethinking issues and the sort of work that John and Alan have done on the region, but think about the urban politics and what goes into the making up of the urban in urban politics, and what other places go into the making up of urban politics in Manchester, for example, or Cleveland. So there's this wider research programme I've been involved with for a number of years, some of it largely unfunded, some of it funded. In particular, interest in the circuits, networks and webs that support the production of the city. So if we can think about the city as being produced and the documentation that goes with that production, what sort of circuits, networks and webs do ideas and knowledge flow through that come into the making up of a particular city? So again, I'm particularly focused around the making of policies that involve places elsewhere. So again, Alan and John have talked about regional assemblages and how that brings together bits of elsewhere. Maybe we can think about that in terms of urban politics and the kind of practical issues about how urban politics is done. So again, referencing this morning and the piece I had in Progress Human Geography, thinking about issues of city-to-city comparison, learning, and issues around mobility and transfer. So these are kind of issues that I'm going to come and describe a number of times over the next half an hour, 40 minutes. Mobile urbanism is one outcome of these intellectual endeavours. This is a book that's coming out next year for Minnesota Press, of which Alan has the foreword, and there's chapters in there by Jenny Robinson, who of course once was here, and Doreen Massey has a chapter in there, alongside other colleagues from around the world who are working on similar issues. So the book's called Mobile Urbanism, Cities and Policymaking in the Global Age. That's the front cover that we eventually decided on after an awful amount of labour. But in a sense, that crystallises, if you like, some of the work that's been going on in this kind of genre of human geography and beyond, actually, over the last 5 or 10 years. Okay. Waterfront. So what the paper does, and there is a paper there if people are interested, what the paper does is starts off by outlining how traditionally political scientists, sociologists, anthropologists, planners and human geographers would conceive of thinking about waterfront redevelopment and urban politics more generally. Now, I'm focusing on waterfront redevelopment because I'm interested in it, I think, and because, as I say, it appears to particular forms of development, but I mean physical development, environmental development, etc., seem to be springing up in a large number of places around the world. But one could also think of other examples, other attempts at kind of more high-profile, spectacular kind of mega-projects that also occur in a number of different cities around the world, and the ways in which increasingly they seem to draw upon a limited number of repertoires about how they actually do things, how they involve people, that kind of thing. Okay, so one of the ways that traditionally people working in this literature have tried to conceive around issues of waterfront redevelopment is to explore the way that the work I actually would have done. So thinking about state restructuring, look at the way the state gets involved in public-private partnerships, in different kind of territorial alliances, different groups of stakeholders that get involved or don't get involved in imagining a future for these waterfront features. Often, many of these waterfront redevelopments are involving ageing economics. So it's about previously productive forms of capital, around ports, for example, either no longer being productive in a narrow kind of way, and thinking about how that land can be revalorized. So it's often about the state involving itself with other actors in imagining a kind of new urban future for these places. And so Neil Brennan might talk about it in terms of new state spaces. He might give that as an example of these things that have emerged. In addition to the issue on governance and management, other studies, and there's a whole set of literatures around the waterfront redevelopment, again, that transcend the social sciences, and actually, more than the social sciences, arts and humanities are also involved. There are a number of architects, artists, who have also worked on issues around waterfront redevelopment and the relationship between humans and water, for example, and the built environment. So planning procedures, sustainable development, political ecological consequences, land reclamation. Again, there's a whole body of literature that exists, largely, though, rooted in very territorial understandings of the urban, by and large. Okay, this work has been hugely insightful, illuminating. It does a lot of interesting insights. Nevertheless, the purpose of the project, of which this is one part, is actually to try and think about things slightly differently, and to try and use this work, but also to think about how one thinks about urban politics from a different perspective. So again, one thinking about when one reads the literature and actually just looks at where these sort of developments are taking place, a number of important questions are raised. So how is it that so many geographically discrete cities have chosen, in quotes, to redevelop their waterfront, often on remarkably similar lines? In what ways do cities with waterfronts learn from each other? Who is involved in the transference and reproduction of waterfront redevelopment from one city to another? So David Harvey, in 1989, produced a piece in Geographische Annalen, of which it's been cited thousands of times. So it's one of the most cited pieces Harvey's produced. And what's interesting about that piece, and the way it fits within this, is that it's been referenced, and an awful lot of people pick up on the notion about shifting from urban municipalism to kind of urban entrepreneurism. The element they don't pick up on, though, is the fact that he starts the paper with a vignette about a workshop that took place, where loads of different people came together and exchanged ideas and brought policies to bear. So there's already a comparative relational reference, set of reference points, and actually that element of the paper, the kind of meeting place, kind of gets forgotten in the way that paper's been cited and circulates. So for me, issues around waterfront redevelopment, these are the kind of issues I'm interested in exploring. And in a sense, what that's involved me doing is thinking about two discrete literatures, also one of which is the comparative urban studies literature. Okay, so if you've got these developments taking place across a number of different cities, what about the comparative urban studies literature? And again, as the piece in Progress Human Geography reviews some of this, but you're talking about anthropology, political science and sociology by and large. There aren't many human geographers who've been involved in these debates. So it's comparing one city to another, looking both for similarities and differences. You know, it's basically about balancing specific individual details with general system-wide tendencies, by and large. This is what most of the comparative urban studies literature has tried to do. That's not without its limits. And perhaps from a geographical perspective, one of the most fundamental limits to this sort of body of work is the fact that it tends to conceive of cities as quite closed, discrete, rather bounded entities. And actually, some of the work that people at the OU have produced, but others, have kind of knocked this one aside and began to question whether actually it makes sense to think about cities in these terms, both now, but actually ever, whether it's appropriate to think about cities in this way. So that's one of the literatures that I've tried to work on. And the other is how one thinks about the making mobile of policies. Okay, so what literature is there out there that sort of tries to grapple with the ways in which ideas or knowledge or policy moves from one place to another? And the one that people who have kind of worked in this area, particularly in the book I showed you, have tried to is the political science literature. There is a political science literature on policy transfer, which tends to have lots of, again, insights, generate lots of insights, but also has a series of limits. First, and the ones I kind of pick up is, first of all, it tends to emphasise the national scale, so that an awful lot of the political science literature on policy transfer is about one nation state having a policy, welfare reform, for example, and about how it's then transferred, quite technocratically, from one country to another. Okay, so that's one issue. The other issue, I think, is that much of this literature kind of downplays the range of actors that are involved in this, and it overemphasises the linearity, the fact that there's a fully formed policy in one place that then could then be uprooted and transplanted and reinvented somewhere else. So, what this paper tries to do when it's thinking about waterfront redevelopment is to try and think about two traditional ways of understanding different elements of the problem, as I see it, or thinking, and try and think about it in a different kind of way. So again, the first one here, and this issue has, this diagram has all kinds of limits, but it tries to get across, I guess, what I'm trying to say. The first is the traditional comparative urban studies. City A and City B are compared. We can understand, we can argue about why they're chosen to be compared in the first place. Nevertheless, you have City A, you have City B, they're compared. There's a kind of framework into which those cities are placed. They're chosen for a particular reason, and then they're compared. The traditional policy transfer literature would have national A policy, national policy B. So it could be crime, it could be anything. And again, there's the sorts of assumptions made. Thinking about things slightly differently is third one, which is actually about thinking about how cities are embedded in relationships between places, and it's not just about one particular city, it's about a range of different cities. So one could think about in this, and I'll talk a bit about it, how City A might be Cleveland, and how it actually makes multiple comparisons that involve the transfer or movement of policy from one place to another. But it also, you know, City E's Baltimore and City D's New York, there's also elements of transfer and movement between those places. So, a work in progress, but in a sense an attempt to capture the bringing together of two different discrete literatures to think about notions of comparison in a more relational sense. So it's not just about comparing A and B, it's about comparing relationships between A and B and what might move between them. What does that mean for thinking about Cleveland, but also thinking about other cities we might know about or be interested in exploring? So Jan Nyman's work on multiple individualising comparisons. So again, the Fermi focus is on one city, Cleveland, City A, but comparisons of a number of other cities, not one, and the labour involved. So it's about who is doing the labour to bring these comparisons to the fore, and then making these comparisons matter in some small way. And as I say, we can all think of examples where, my one's Cleveland, but other examples of the way in which cities are embedded in multiple kind of forms of comparison. Second, thinking about mapping existing interconnection networks. So in a sense, an element of this is about following policy and practice. So it's not quite doing what the other Ian Cook has done, which is about follow the commodity, but it is a bit about that. It's about following something back. It's about seeing where an idea comes from that gets turned into a policy, and see mapping those networks. So that's slightly different, I think, about rather than imposing some sort of order or comparative framework on two or more, you know, three, four, five, six, seven cities. Which obviously means it's messier. It's more messy and more complicated than perhaps past ways of thinking about doing comparison. Third, again, the notion of policy transfer is much broader than how the term is used in the political science. So policy is understood in a broader sense as sets of bundles of expertise, learning and knowledge codified in one way or another into policy form. Again, it doesn't have to be a kind of very narrow focus on a enclosed, concluded, finished product. And transfer is not one-off. Notions of transfer movement, it's an embodied movement, it's not disembodied. Okay, so in a sense, and again, trying to explore the kind of embodied sense in which movement takes place, which can be about informal, mundane, ordinary activities, as well as the other elements of transfer that get written about. Fourth, thinking about cities as understood as openly, internally differentiated, temporally assembled and given coherence, but constituted in and through circuits, networks and webs, of varying, using John and others' work, about geographical reach. So thinking about what it means to think about it in those terms. Okay, so what the paper does, as I say, is to think about the example of Cleveland, one city, using this kind of framework as a way of thinking about how one understands something like, I'm going to come and talk about this one plan, in a way that doesn't just collapse back to traditional territorial understandings of the urban. That's not to say some of those traditional ways of thinking about territorial understanding of the urban aren't useful. They are, they still are. It's about, I guess, asking a different set of questions. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit about Cleveland, and the reason why Cleveland was chosen was simply about the fact that it seemed to, I was aware of some developments taking place, various community groups and other non-state actors getting involved in trying to campaign against a particular form of waterfront re-event that was taking place. And then looking into it, it became clear that actually there was an awful lot of movement of ideas and policies from one place to another, and that was shaping the way that Cleveland, in quotes, was developing. Anyway, those who don't know much about Cleveland, actually, the paper talks a little bit about Cleveland, though it tries to rehearse the same old way one talks about these places. So first of all, Cleveland, though, we'll quote from Wharf and Holly from over a decade ago now, talk about Cleveland in the 1970s and 80s embodied the worst aspects of the Rust Belt: deindustrialization, population loss, rising poverty, ugly landscapes and a notoriously poor reputation. Leaving aside all the kind of ways you might think about Cleveland in a more positive light, nevertheless, academically at least, and in terms of the way it mattered in local political and practitioner circles, Cleveland was very much positioned as a failing city in lots of ways, economically, politically, even if it had its ways of thinking about. Nevertheless, thinking about Cleveland, it's a bit like thinking about cities like Liverpool and Manchester, is that actually it's a city whose fate was always constituted through its relationships elsewhere. So that's an image that was used in the 1970s, an attempt to promote Cleveland vis-a-vis other ports. So it says, great seaports of the world, Cleveland downright, where else can a seaman find a waterfront bar with over 80 different kinds of imported beer? It's a very masculine attempt to promote Cleveland through a particular bit of industry. And the chap here has tattooed Liverpool, Hong Kong, Rotterdam and Cleveland. So again, there's an implicit comparison by placing Cleveland next to those other places. I would imagine now, if you had someone from Richard, Florida, for example, wouldn't look like this necessarily, because it'd be a different kind of embodied experience. And secondly, certainly wouldn't have Liverpool, Hong Kong, Rotterdam next to Cleveland. You might have Cleveland next to San Francisco, or Cleveland next to another set of places that may be more intrinsically attractive. So in a sense, his arm is doing some work for Cleveland. It's placing Cleveland next to other places in the same sentence, which does its own labour, does its own work. Anyway, this is interesting, and it was part of a series of campaigns to utilise Cleveland's history, and history being one of relationships to other places, and to promote the city in that way. So again, I think that, you know, we can tell a story about lots of different cities this way, but I think for Cleveland it's interesting. Okay, and essentially, the story about Cleveland is essentially an attempt to relocate the port on Lake Erie. We don't need to know all the details. Again, there's a paper, people can read about it. It's essentially an attempt to relocate the port and develop the waterfront. It's not an uncommon story. There's a large chunk of land that's going to be left. What do we do with it? Given it's the 21st century, it's all about the new economy, it's about creative cities. What can we do to promote Cleveland and insert it into some sort of hierarchy of cities? Okay. Well, the first thing the city and other local territorial stakeholders have attempted to do is, again, unsurprisingly, when you think about what other cities try to do, is to set up a kind of range of territorial initiatives. So, Port Authority was created in 1968, foreign trade zones in 1978. Again, the classic kind of thing: incentivise business to relocate to those places, keep the economy ticking over, because clearly, even at this stage in the 60s and 70s, and it still actually is now, it's still a major local employer of labour in a part of the world where actually there are jobs have been lost. So the port is still economically important, but recent initiatives have attempted to kind of decenter the impact of the port, and actually, even if manufacturing in the port still remains important, to try and create a different kind of Cleveland, okay, to move it away from all the other lifestyle things that go on around it being a port, in the way that this person embodies certain values and things. Okay, so history of the 1980s again is again not dissimilar to other places. So in 1984, City Vision 2000, also it's interesting when you date a document, because the document just dates that much quicker. So you call it something called City Vision 2000, was initiated, again, a honing of development of the waterfront. 1988 was Cleveland Civic Vision Downtown Plan. What there was essentially was an agreement in the 80s and 90s that what Cleveland needed was, again, not dissimilar to other places we might have all been to. If you go to the AAG, for example, large-scale retail, office and hotel development, entertainment and sports attractions to attract tourists, and a physical modernisation of the central business district. That's a quote from Keating on Cleveland. So there's a series of documents led by local authority but with other territorial stakeholders about what should be done with this land on the basis that long-term economic sustainability of the port wasn't necessarily guaranteed, and actually it was taking up too much space in an area that could be used. You know, we could exchange, increase the value of these areas. And what was interesting for me, though, was, in a sense, looking back at some of these documents and seeing how other places were referenced in those documents. So, Baltimore was the model for waterfront redevelopment. So throughout the 1980s, whenever attempts to kind of reorientate local stakeholders to make a case for a different kind of Cleveland, where was the place that other people went to? Where was the place that other people came from? And where were the other places that get referenced in these documentation? So Cleveland wasn't alone in doing this. So it wasn't the only place that was referencing Baltimore's Inner Harbour to observe what was going on. They weren't the only place to host visiting architects, developers and planners involved in the redevelopment of Baltimore's Inner Harbour. Again, if you do read pieces on Baltimore, or you read pieces more generally on, there aren't many of them, about other places that have taken on the Baltimore model, the work of Stephen Ward, who's a historical planner at the Oxford Brookes University, has written about the way the Baltimore model travelled around the world. A quote here, the initial plan was just to create a destination on the downtown waterfront. That was creation of the physical North Coast Harbour. There was dredging there and creating a harbour. And it was very much based, without apologies, on a Baltimore's inner harbour. I mean, there was the model that was used. It was pretty much a direct steal. So what one saw in the 80s and early 90s was an attempt to rethink the built environment, the imagined economy, if you like, of Cleveland through references, particularly to Baltimore. There were references to other places, but Baltimore in particular was the model that was used. And that led, as I say, to local stakeholders visiting Baltimore and finding out what's going on. It involved people who were involved in Baltimore coming to Cleveland and giving talks. It involved the exchange of ideas, and it also involved architects and planners and engineers who were involved in one model, essentially moving around and getting involved in a range of different kind of examples. And again, in some senses, if you were to read the story of Cleveland and its development, at least by many academics, you wouldn't pick up on this, because this is an element of the story that gets kind of left aside. Most of the stories, particularly by political scientists and sociologists, tend to be focused on those people who are embedded in Cleveland. Okay, so and what happened? Well, these were the kind of success stories. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Great Lakes Science Centre, and the redeveloped Cleveland Browns football stadium were all built in the 1990s. So there were kind of physical, tangible restructuring of the materiality of the urban environment. Okay, through, as a result of these less physical, less material, perhaps we could argue, inflows of ideas. Unfortunately, and unsurprisingly if it had been to Cleveland, the attractions became seen as enclosed islands of daytime vibrancy in a sea of rarely used and fragmented outdoor spaces. So what was seen as a good idea and as the way forward actually apparently failed to work in a way that it apparently worked in Baltimore, Boston, Chicago, New York. So what was left were pockets of redeveloped areas around the waterfront, but with no real attempt to bring those pockets into play in the city, in the downtown, and to just generally reshape the way that people in Cleveland and people from outside Cleveland perceive the downtown, the city. Okay, so then we experienced another raft of territorial initiatives. So new mayor Michael White, he updated the City Vision 2000 plan. The city went from the City Vision 2000 plan to the Civic Vision 2000 and beyond was launched. So again, once you put the date in 2000, you're then benchmarking it, so it's 2000 and beyond, which is obviously more open-ended. And again, produced a not unsurprisingly unsurprising set of initiatives. So new convention centre and hotel, so the sort of place if you went to an AAG you'd probably stay at, an aquarium, a Reno Crawford Museum of Transportation, a transit centre, redevelopment of a corridor, and 10,000 residential units. So again, this was the second wave of an attempt to recapitalise, redevelop this area of the waterfront. I won't go into all these details, but essentially what happened is Baltimore is no longer the model to which people in Cleveland aspire. It's Chicago. Chicago's Navy Pier. Okay, so the documents have lots of different photographs of Chicago's Navy Pier as being sold as a success story. Okay, Mayor White was aided by Chicago architects, VOA, involved in the co-design of Navy Pier. So they were brought in to redevelop the waterfront, or at least to produce the blueprints. A number of senior staff from the mayor's office went to Chicago Navy Pier, fact-finding mission, bit of policy tourism, went round, found out, spoke to people, and thought about how what had happened in Chicago may be appropriate. And of course, the proximity between Chicago and Cleveland, much more than Scarborough and Baltimore, there's already a history of comparisons between those two. Someone can think about this as a process of comparison learning and rendering mobile of certain knowledge. So if one can think about channels of transfer or whatever terminology you want to use, there was clearly a sense whereby that having been opened up to the possibility of learning from other places and benchmarking reference themselves, the emphasis shifted away from Baltimore and shifted towards Chicago and what might be possible in terms of learning from Chicago. The plan was agreed in 2004, but perhaps unsurprisingly, despite what I'm saying about the relationships that stretch across space and reach into other places, territory still matters. And so what happens in 2004 is, through various disputes over turf, about territory, over claims, about whose, in whose name is the redevelopment taking place, nothing happens. There is no movement forward. Plans stall. You know, community groups are up in arms because the money that's being spent on the waterfront should be spent elsewhere. Local businesses don't think it's flexible enough. They don't want to see more high-profile developments. So it was only in 2008, when again another change of mayor, that the return to the waterfront takes place. So, having made a kind of argument for thinking about this particular city in a more than territorial way, if you like, I want to just talk a little bit about the 2009 plan, partly because it's ended up going nowhere as well. So as we're now at the end of 2010, they're still in stasis about what should happen. But there was a moment where various things happened that looked like something quite significant would happen on the waterfront, as in the port would be relocated and this waterfront area would be redeveloped. So one of the things that characterised this 2009 plan is both a classic academic kind of thing, but continuity and change. So in some senses, it was about another element, another wave of referencing other places. But there was differences, I think. Experts situated elsewhere were brought to Cleveland to provide fresh and knowledgeable ideas. So there was a clear sense by those people we spoke to inside the city that they couldn't learn, they weren't to learn from its past, because the past was a failure, it had not been successful. And actually what they should be doing is speaking to other people in other cities who had undergone a kind of successful redevelopment of its waterfront and think about what Cleveland could learn from them. And I'm just going to go through a number of these different examples of the kind of people that were involved in these ideas and exchanges. So the first group of architects were E.E. and K., who won the tender to master plan the lakefront site. These were the first group of experts who were brought to bear. And again, there's Donald McNeil and Maria Kiker at Manchester have written about the kind of emergence of global architects and the way that architects have been influential globally in shaping the developments of a number of different cities. And this is no different. Architects were there leading the front, developing the master plan into which other bits could slide. So E and K are nationally recognised architects. They were based elsewhere, but they were able to bring experience and knowledge on how to regenerate waterfronts. So when you were hiring them, you weren't just hiring them as an organisation, you were hiring them and buying essentially their reputational capital. Okay, you were bringing them in as bodies and getting them involved in shaping the way that redevelopment should take place. Okay, so they brought with them certain levels of expertise and knowledge that they'd appropriated from other places. Second, a whole range of international consultancy firms, unsurprisingly, were hovering in the background. PA Consultant, Rebel Group and Carl Real Estate. They were commissioned by the Port Authority to write Cleveland Waterfront Market, Demand and Development Options. Again, these documents are not uncommon if you know a bit about these sorts of developments. This sought to show what is possible in Cleveland and provide practical lessons of how this can be achieved. So their job essentially was to demonstrate to the various publics, so the kind of mainstream public, but other stakeholders, federal government, regional government, a whole range of other territorial stakeholders, that having developed this blueprint, this waterfront plan, it could be delivered. There was a market, if you like, for some of the things they were offering. And again, this document contains the normal array of photographs, graphs, pie charts, and kind of hyperbole about what's possible with Cleveland. The third group, I think, which was interesting, were a high-profile expert regeneration practitioners who were keynote speakers at a prominent forum. So one of the other things that's interesting about this is fairly mundane, ordinary events, often quite unsexy, that take place, but that form important parts of the narratives that are told about the ways in which Cleveland might develop. and I think it's not dissimilar to other places. So there was an event took place called Transforming Cleveland by Building a World-Class Waterfront. Okay, it's a place at one of the local colleges of urban affairs. There were a number of people, in this case it was Tom Murphy, Juana Lau and David Taylor, who spoke about their hands-on experience in developing the areas of Pittsburgh, Bilbao and London. So these were three examples of places that were seen to undergo a successful waterfront redevelopment that had successfully shifted the economic base of the local economy and have been brought to bear a whole range of particularly capital investment. So it wasn't just about the state, but it was about bringing capital to bear into these projects. Pittsburgh, Bilbao and London were seen as being successful, so they invited the three people who led on these developments to come in and talk about their experiences. And again, it was about facilitating the inflow of ideas and knowledge about how Cleveland might redevelop itself. Look, I won't go all those, but essentially there was a whole series of other forms of exchange. A very mundane, ordinary emails, telephone calls, face-to-face and virtual. It was about a degree of relational proximity. It was about bringing people closer together, even if it wasn't physically, through which they could talk about and exchange ideas about how Cleveland might be redeveloped. So these were, if you like, platforms that provide particular ways in which ideas were framed and circulated and lubricated the channels for mobilising trans-urban policy. And it's in this context that the master plan was finalised in September 2009. Okay, so far from it being a product that was produced in Cleveland, it was a product that actually involved a whole range of other individuals, mostly based in the US, but not all. Okay. In addition to the qualitative aspect to it, again, many of the initiatives require some sort of quantitative, numeric evidence. So the Cleveland Waterfront Market Demand and Development Options, which was produced by a consultancy firm, listed 10 examples of waterfront redevelopment elsewhere and had a whole series of key performance indicators against which people should Cleveland should consume. So I won't read them all, but there's a whole range of people from around different bits of the world, Global North and Global South. All of these places were seen as successful. They're all case studies. So this document was doing a bit of comparison. It was the crudest, most reductionist form of comparison, but it was doing some comparison. And again, that document produced, circulated, exchanged, commented on, and shaped the kind of ways in which those people who had some sort of territorial stake in Cleveland approached the redevelopment. I also should say the document's very boring, like most of these documents in lots of ways. There's some interesting elements to it, but some of it is simply about producing a thick document that is seen to legitimise certain ways of redeveloping the waterfront. So there's a qualitative dimension, the bringing in and out of people, the referencing of people, formally and informally, the uses of conferences, workshops and forums where exchange and ideas take place. But there's also the production of documents where these sorts of numbers, and of course some numbers are produced and others aren't. So Lahn and Leheron talk about how the global has become more knowable by placing the experiences and performances of other cities into quantitatively and qualitatively encoded proximity. And there's an example of that, this document, and there are lots of others as well. And again, the sort of data they use is property values over time, cost, project duration, development sizes, unit numbers and land use percentages. So again, it's about situating Cleveland in relationship to other places that have pursued the same sort of initiatives that Cleveland and those that were involved in its development. Okay. Now obviously what I'm doing in the paper slightly is glossing over the internal differences within those who are the stakeholder in Cleveland. But nevertheless, the point of the paper is actually to think about its external reaches. Okay. So cities shepherd into line, the unknown rendered both knowable and comparable. This is the sort of work these documents do. And of course, that document didn't then end as a document. It was picked up on local media. I won't play it, but a local radio station. There's a number of local radio stations where they discuss the document. They invite the authors on. They talk about it. Josephine and Joe Public from Cleveland ring up and ask questions about the document and ask about the waterfront and what's going to happen. Okay, so its impact resonates out and begins to shape the kind of public perception. And of course what happened, this has happened after a number of very public failures to attempt to redevelop the waterfront. So urban complexity reduced to a series of numbers, stories, tables and images, bringing into comparative coexistent territories from around the world. So, you know, the South African examples are completely disembedded from the wider South African context, city, region, nation state examples. Okay. just by way of a conclusion, to go back to some of the kind of opening points I made. So, a quote here, I mean, I'm quite sensitive because New York is deemed as a very different kind of place than the rest of the country, and it's really different. You need to be careful. You have to be sensitive. You have to be careful not to say you have to be like Battery Park City, because that is not the point of our comparisons. This is a quote from one of the figures, one of the individuals who was involved in the Cleveland redevelopment, who's reflecting a kind of a more nuanced way than many of the people we spoke to about what you have to do with comparison, the kind of claims you can make around it. And the paper has a whole series of quotes from a range of people talking about the importance of comparison. Okay. So what? Just 4 points. The paper, first of all, makes clear the way that Cleveland was diagnosed as failing. This was not a diagnosis that everyone in the city shared. There were a range of dissenting voices, but nevertheless, a narrative emerged from inside the city, but from outside as well, about the fact that Cleveland as a city was failing, and there was the need to do something different. And that actually it was being compared unfavourably to other places. So comparison was still there, but Cleveland was being told it wasn't doing what it should do, and it compared New York, Baltimore, Boston, for example. So through the 80s and 90s, there were waves of strategising have involved making reference to other places. Lots of examples of policy tourism, so places, people going to places, other people coming to Cleveland in exchange in a very mundane, ordinary way about knowledge and ideas and how that shapes into a policy agenda. So lots of examples of the labour that's involved in assembling the document. Okay, very temporary, precarious, but nevertheless, the number of people, labour that's involved, public and private sector, a whole range of different kind of actors involved in this. Thirdly, I think the example of Cleveland, and maybe we can think about other ones we might know more about, seems to reaffirm that urban policy development occurs in a self-consciously comparative context. And again, I think it's possible to think about past understandings of urban politics or local economic development and think about it in these terms. So the story is essentially one about thinking about contemporary examples in a kind of through this lens, but I think it's also possible to go back and revisit. One can argue, and others have argued, that actually what distinguishes this period, by which I mean the last 15 or 20 years, from previous waves, is a more professional industry emerging around comparison. Rise of consultancies, think tanks, a whole range of knowledge producers, in addition to academics, about places, think tanks, consultants, civil society, all kinds of examples of the ways in which, and the internet's obviously facilitated that as well, architects, engineers, others who have been involved in producing knowledge and information, that again, industry suggests a kind of coherentness to it all. But nevertheless, there is that group of individuals who have been involved in these kind of activities in a more professional sense than maybe was in the case of the past. I think the other thing I would make, and this is the kind of sentence that one ends a paper on, so this is the last point I'm going to say today, is basically, I think, and I make the case that this example of Cleveland at least suggests that if you're going to think about the territorial politics of the city, it's important we reflect on what and where goes into the making up of the urban in urban politics. And so again, one of the things that runs through the paper is to say that actually there's a whole range of different places figure in urban politics, and I've just listed three about blueprints, expertise and knowledge. Okay, thanks very much.